Miami's tough relationship with the Marlins and finding the solution to plastic pollution. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The city of Miami made a deal with the Marlins years ago that if the team was sold, part of the profits would go back to the city. Well, the team was sold for $1.2 billion a few years ago. Jeffrey Loria, former owner, claims he lost money, and Miami's cut from the deal is barely a few million. How did that happen? Also, seafood lovers may be surprised to learn that very little of the fish they eat comes from South Florida's coasts. We'll learn more about illegal fishing markets from abroad and their impact on the environment. And finally, cities in Florida currently can't ban plastics. But are local bans enough? How do we learn to live with and reduce our need for plastic? All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. A mayor lost his job over it. An owner sold his team, and a city gets paid, though not what they were looking for. Anyone who lived in Miami over the last 10 plus years is well aware of the saga over Marlins Park. Back in 2009, the park was paid for by public tax dollars to the tune of more than $600 million. The city agreed to pay for it as long as the team's owner, Jeffrey Loria, shared in any of the profits that they made from selling the team. So he did in 2017, but he didn't want to share because he claimed that he lost money. By the way, he sold the team again, did I tell you, for $1.2 billion? A lawsuit ensued, and this week a settlement was reached. WLRN reporter Danny Rivero joins us now for a little more of this saga. Danny, yeah, a lot of us remember this story about that. It's a beautiful stadium, but a very pricey one.
That is right. It's a, you know, it stands as a monument to the collapse of people's, of a lot of people in Miami-Dade faith in local government. I mean, this was really a moment where, you know, the public got outraged about something. And, you know, it all started, you know, you can debate where it started, but basically in 2008, it was Jeffrey Loria, the former owner of the Marlins, that was threatening to leave Miami if he didn't get a new stadium. And also the MLB president at the time, Bob Dupuy, I think I'm saying his name right, basically put an ultimatum to the county and the city saying, look, if you guys don't help finance a new stadium, you can kiss baseball in South Florida goodbye.
And it's so strange to say that considering the Marlins had won two World Series, right, by that point?
Right, yeah. I mean, they came on as an expansion team in the mid-90s, I believe, and won the World Series in 97 and in 2003. Big moments for the city. But, yeah, Jeffrey Loria, as the owner, he became kind of notorious for underfunding the team, you know, kind of maximizing his profit margins even after that, you know, World Series victory in 2003, basically hollowed out the team, brought in new players, and it really killed the fan base for a while, because those legacy players that we thought we had, we saw them move on.
The next year. Now, we had former Miami mayor Manny Diaz and former Miami-Dade mayor Carlos Alvarez. So they basically, the pressure was on them, build the stadium or lose the team. And, you know, especially, I believe it was Mayor Alvarez and really pushed hard. Okay, we have to do this.
That's right. And the thinking behind this was, look, this is something that is going to help tourism. A lot of the funds came out of funds that were designated for tourism. And the thinking was, if we build this and we build it, you know, the site is an amazing site. You know, you can't deny that. It's where the former Orange Bowl was. It's pretty much in the heart of Miami. And the thinking was, you build it, they will come. It's literally a metaphor they used in debating this. And, you know, that hasn't quite happened. And it came at a, you know, a hell of an expense. You know, the cost, the county put about $500 million towards this, but that's not the final, that's not where it ends. You know, like, once the county had to take out public bonds to do this, and yes, this all came out after the fact.
And by the way, this was all happening after we were hitting a recession. We were in the recession.
Right. We were at the beginning ish part of the recession, but it was clear that a recession was starting to happen.
Yeah.
And the county had to take out 40-year bonds to finance building the stadium. And, you know, it was about $500 million. But once you project it forward 40 years with interest, et cetera, it's $2.4 billion that taxpayers are have to pay back.
And what happened to the legacy of those two mayors?
So Carlos Alvarez, the Miami-Dade mayor at the time, was actually we set up a recall election in Miami-Dade County, and he was taken out of office. It's one of the largest recalls, public recalls of a public figure in U.S. history. It's like really monumental in that way. So his political legacy from then on was basically shot. You know, he's not doing much politically. The city of Miami mayor Manny Diaz was actually term limited out, like right on the heels of when the public outrage on this started.
Yeah.
So he didn't have to face that kind of recall election. He's actually back in the public spotlight because he was recently elected as the chair of the Florida Democratic Party.
Yeah.
So he's definitely back in the mix.
And as you said, those were bonds over 40 years. This taxpayers here are going to be paying for the stadium for a while. Again, talking with WLRN's Danny Rivero, talking about the city of Miami's fight to get more money from former Miami Marlin owner Jeffrey Loria. Again, he sold the team. There was an agreement that we get some of that money back. We get some of it, but he claimed right. He lost money. It was a $1.2 billion sale. The city, Danny, gets what? $4 million barely?
Right. So there's like, it's 4.2 total that the county and the city together are getting. The county's getting the bulk of that, about 3.2 million, according to the terms of the settlement. And the city will get just over $500,000 back, which is okay. Not very much.
I mean, first of all, do we understand how can Loria claim he lost money when he sold the team for a profit over what he paid for?
Right. Loria bought the team in 2002 for like $158 million and he sold it in 2017 for $1.2 billion. And I think any reasonable person can argue that the building of the stadium that they play in contributed, you know, in a great deal to the value of the company, of the team. But the county and the city have basically argued that when Loria sold it for $1.2 billion, he actually claimed that he sold it at a loss. And he because of that, he said, well, I don't owe the county or the city any money on this. And that is what led to the lawsuit with the county and the city saying, hold on, like, there's no way that math adds up. You know, like, we're clearly, you know, owed something. The taxpayers are owed something from this huge profit. And the settlement that we have has come up in the midst of this lawsuit, because there's two tracks. Either they may reach some kind of a settlement agreement, or they're going to have to go into private arbitration. And the county commissioners heard it this week. They said, this is the settlement. Should we take it? And the county commission said, no, we should not take it. You know, they're basically operating on the assumption that Jeffrey Loria and the former owners of the Marlins are not operating in good faith. And they want to peek behind the numbers a little bit more, get a better understanding of if this is actually what they're owed, because they feel like they should maybe be owed a lot more than they're getting.
Yeah. So they voted not to accept the settlement, but to look deeper into it. Do we know what happens now? Are they going to go to arbitration?
Right. So where it stands now is that the county commissioners are going to meet with the county lawyers that have been kind of involved in the settlement. And they're going to get like individual briefings about all the details of what they know so far from what they've been able to learn through the process of the lawsuit and just get a peek under the hood, if you will.
And this has been one of the challenges, is the fact that the Marlins never had to show their books. They never had to show, you know, their accounting and what they make right. And how much. So is this a matter of the county, the city having to sue to be able to look at their accounting?
Yeah. I mean, it might be. And yeah, to your point, I mean, when this was approved, the Marlins publicly represented things that were just not true. You know, it was all the sports website Deadspin actually got some leaked documents after the fact. That was the first time that we learned, oh, the Marlins is actually, you know, doing a lot better financially than what they were representing. And, you know, and then now we're in the midst of, because there's a possible settlement or maybe you go to arbitration, we're on the cusp of learning more about you know, what is behind the hood, you know? And, you know, some of that is yet to be seen, but there's a general sense that, you know, Loria has not been transparent. This has been proven. And is there something else there?
Yeah. And of course, all of this, again, just, it kind of destroyed that relationship with the city. Do you think it's new owners now, Derek Jeter's one of the owners, that if they build a team that wins, that the fans would come back, they would kind of just let the whole stadium thing go, or they're always going to see that stadium and be reminded of the fact that they're still paying for it? We're still paying for that.
I live right next to it, basically. And I think about that often when I drive past it, because a lot of the retail and stuff on the ground level that we were promised, it was going to be this huge business district and whatnot.
Right.
Like, a lot of that's empty. Up and down, the promises that were made were not fulfilled. I mean, that's just a fact of life right now. But we do have new ownership relatively, right, with Derek Jeter and his team. And they are starting to turn the team around. You know, the team did make the playoffs last year for the first time in a long time. Attendance continues to be an issue. It's just the perennial issue with the Miami Marlins.
Yeah.
But, you know, if we do a lot better in the future, you know, maybe they can get some of that back.
Maybe. We'll see. Hopefully. All right. Danny Rivero from WLRN, thank you so much for the insight and the history.
Thank you, Lewis.
Yep. You know what? I got to tell you, I think if the team wins, we get some stars. The team wins. Maybe we'll let go of the fact that we're going to be paying for that stadium for a long, long time. Well, later in the show, we're going to be talking about plastic pollution, and we want to hear your thoughts. Do you think plastics should be banned by local governments? Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial, or email us your thoughts, sundial@wlrnnews.org, because that's coming up later in the show, and I want to read some of your comments and questions. Well, still to come, that can of tuna in your cabinet may be illegally sourced. We're going to explain why illegal fishing is having devastating effects on marine life. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. When was the last time you had a spicy tuna roll, or you bought salmon from your local Publix? Do you know where that fish comes from? Well, according to the World Wildlife Foundation, the U.S. imports approximately 5 billion pounds of fish each year, and it's nearly impossible to pinpoint just how much of that fish is coming from illegal sources. Marine ecosystems have been devastated by unregulated markets and overfishing. This week, FIU is hosting their annual State of the World Conference, a virtual 5-day event featuring speakers like former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and former Costa Rican President Luis Guillermo Solis. Solis is the interim chair of the Kimberly Green Latin American and Caribbean Center at FIU, and he recently presented on the illegal fishing market. And he joins us now. President Solis, thank you so much for the time.
My pleasure, Luis. Thank you very much for having me.
Help us understand the scope of this problem, illegal fishing. How much of the fish in the supermarket do I know is legal? How much of it's illegal?
Well, approximately 1 out of 7. But nobody knows really, because as you've mentioned, this is a huge problem. I mean, fishing around the world represents a business of nearly $35 billion a year. And this is a huge amount. And we are facing a problem that doesn't only refer to illegal fishing, because that's bad enough, but illegality in fishing can be tackled more or less easily. The problem is with unreported and unregulated fishing. And this is what the conference was about. Illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing, which makes illegal fishing look like an iceberg. I mean, you only see the top of it. But under the waterline, there's a whole world of atrocities committed, not only in terms of fishing itself, but also in terms of human rights and corruption.
Well, how do we determine then, you know, if the food we're eating is legal or illegal? Because we're buying it from legitimate vendors. So, I mean, is there a safeguard in place?
Well, some vendors are now tracing fish and crustaceans, as it was the case with beef. And there are ongoing efforts in a number of venues to enhance that kind of tracing. That's the only way to do it, because the volumes are so staggering that even when there's goodwill and when the authorities are willing to uphold the law, There's still margin for a lot of fish to go unreported, and this is the problem that we were facing. You know, it requires, or we are facing, and requires a lot of cooperation, a lot of sharing of intelligence, and also a lot of participation on the part of the public.
You know, fishing, as you know, fishing used to be a very big part of the Costa Rican economy, but in recent years, that's shrunk because of this issue of illegal fishing. But help me understand what happened in your home country and how it affected the people. I mean, what happened? How did you get to where you're at now? Because maybe we can learn something from that.
Well, I think Costa Rica is no exception to what's happening in other parts of the world. And in fact, we are not probably as bad as some countries in Africa or Asia, whose oceans have been, or seas have been, adjacent seas have been basically depleted of fishing. Costa Rica is 10 times larger at sea than it is on land. We're only 50,000 square kilometers, 25,000 square miles approximately on land, and 500,000 square kilometers on the sea, 250,000 miles, square miles. That's a lot of sea to cover for a little country that doesn't have the resources. Not until very recently, thanks to a program that was established with the support of the U.S. Coast Guard, did we get enough coverage. I mean, three cutters for that big sea, which was a great improvement until now, but I don't think it's sufficient for the future to keep our waters. So we have been mapping them. We have made sectors. We have done all sorts of efforts to differentiate the areas where the artisan fishermen can fish and where the semi-industrial or longline fishing vessels can fish, etc. But it's a matter of resources. It's a matter of availability of technology, which is also a very important part of it, although it's not a silver bullet. You know, it has to do with the willingness of our neighboring states to comply with international law and with local law as well.
First of all, I'm just trying to picture you had three Coast Guard cutters. You know, they're decent sized boats, not that big, covering that kind of span of ocean. That's massive. You know what? When you just look at Costa Rican waters, who's doing the illegal fishing? Do we know?
Well, there are all sorts of fleets. Some are, you know, from far away countries like China, Taiwan. But some others are from Latin America. Not all of them do the illegal fishing. Again, you know, some of them do comply with the law. So it's very difficult to point at culprits here. But repeatedly, we have seen problems with Peruvian, Ecuadorian, Chinese vessels. And these problems have also repeated themselves in other places. Yeah. One of the things that we have to be aware of is that many of these boats, the ships, have to wear devices that would identify them. Well, they turn it off sometimes when they get into your territorial waters, and then you lose track of them.
And by the way, you know, when they're in Costa Rican waters, what are they looking for specifically? What type of fish are they trying to get?
Well, there are all sorts of fish they look for, mostly pelagic species, the highly migratory species like tuna, for example, or some billfish, swordfish, also a dolphin, or as we're called, mahi-mahi here in Florida.
Yeah. So is it just about stepping up the enforcement? As you said, you're working with the U.S. Is it more enforcement, or, I mean, do you have to reach out to especially the Asian countries, to try to double up on enforcement there? What do you think is going to be the solution?
Well, it has to include enforcement, and not only with the U.S., but with neighboring countries. We're working strongly with Colombia, with Ecuador, with Panama. But in around the world, it has to do also with intelligence sharing. It has to do with a very necessary dialogue with private business. They sometimes are not aware that the fish they buy is unreported fishing or unregulated fishing. It has to do with customers, people demanding that their supermarkets, the places where they buy food, trace the fish. This is going to take a long time, but you know, citizen education is very important.
And
yeah, so and there are a number of measures that ought to be implemented.
That's, let me get to that point too with a customer, because I think about what you said at the beginning. 1 in 7. So when I go to the supermarket and I'm looking at the fish in front of me, that 1 in 7 is basically coming from an illegal source. As a customer, as a consumer, you know, just dive a little bit more into what exactly can I do? The little guy, what can I possibly do?
Well, one of the things, again, you know, is insist with the stores that sell the fish to try to identify the source of their food. I know that there are very responsible chains that do this. It is easier when fish comes from farms, you know, when it is not caught wild in the ocean. But again, it's a question that takes time. It is also costly. You have to remember, Lewis, that fish is the source of the principal source of protein in the world.
Yeah.
And lots of populations throughout the world only depend on fish to survive. This is one of the most devastating impacts that illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing has, because it takes away the only source of protein that many coastal communities have throughout the world.
Again, I'm talking with Luis Guillermo Solis, the former president of Costa Rica. He is now the interim chair of the Kimberly Green Latin American and Caribbean Center at FIU. And FIU, by the way, hosting its State of the World Conference this week. It's entirely virtual, of course. We have more information about it on our social media at WLRN Sundial. President Solis, I wanted to ask you about, just switching gears a little bit. We're in a new administration here in the United States, of course, as you know. And I'm wondering what you're hearing from colleagues back in Costa Rica. What are the expectations they have from the Biden administration and how he works with Latin America?
Well, I've heard very good news. Fortunately, Costa Rica has traditionally had a very good relationship with the United States. I was fortunate enough to coexist. My administration coexisted with two U.S. administrations, my first 2 years with President Obama, the second 2 years with President Trump, and they were wonderful, both. You know, the cooperation levels were superb, and we keep it. But with the what I hear is that that the new administration is following suit. President Biden, President Carlos Alvarado, spoke on the phone after President Biden was elected, and I think that there's a lot of understanding of our common agenda, and it's going to be pushed through successfully, I hope, as it has been in the past.
You know what? It's interesting. You said under Trump as well. So, what was he doing? Was he basically doing the same when it came to relations with Costa Rica as Obama? Or, I mean, what was anything different?
Well, you know, the bigger programs we have, combating drugs, stimulating environmental policies, supporting our Coast Guard. You know, those bigger programs remained in place. For almost a year and a half, President Trump kept Vice President Pence kept President Obama's team working with him in the office while he renewed the team, and that was the same team that then Vice President Biden had relating to Central American issues. So there was a lot of continuity among the team, and then the other thing is that Costa Rica, fortunately, doesn't have the migration issues that we see in other parts of Central America and the Northern
right.
Triangle. So that was a point of contention that we did not have with the Trump administration.
Yeah. What do you want to see in these first 100 days, though, in the Biden administration?
Well, you know, I think that it is only justified that the president and his equipment and his team is mostly solving internal problems, domestic problems, economic and the pandemic. I think that this is what should be done. It's the most important action that he can take, you know, putting the pandemic under control with support of the people and also stabilizing the economy. After that, I'm sure he will deal with other international issues. But being a resident in Florida for the time being, I really hope that the pandemic issue will be put to rest as soon as possible.
And yeah, I just wanted to know the pandemic, you know, again, a global issue, how Costa Rica is handling it right now.
It did very well at the very beginning because we have a very solid universal social security system, very similar to the ones in Europe or in Canada. And we were able to control it for the first 90 days. Then we had to open the economy as everybody else. And that meant, you know, an increase in cases. And we have been dealing with high numbers since then. But fortunately, the hospital services have not been saturated, and we have not seen in Costa Rica some of the terrible images we saw in Europe, and we continue to see in some parts of the Latin America.
So let me finish with this. I'm going to come back to, again, the issue we were talking about earlier on the issue of illegal fishing. And what role do you see? I mean, again, the United States helping you out, but what role do you see not just the U.S., but all the countries around you playing in trying to deal with this problem? Do you think it's realistic to say we can get a grip on it in the next 4, 5, 6 years?
Well, I hope so. I mean, the tone, the general tone of the conference yesterday was very alarming, and people were very concerned. But as Ambassador Gene Mains, the second in command, the civilian liaison with Admiral Fowler, said there are lots of things that are being done, and I think the stars are aligning so that in some years we will be able to deal with this issue effectively. I must say that the work that the United States has been doing has been placing, and the efforts by the Coast Guard, U.S. Coast Guard, are phenomenal. It has been illegal, unregulated, and unreported fishing has been determined, has been defined as of the highest national security importance. And this is very important in the Western Hemisphere. It's going to be fundamental because it will allow for greater degrees of collaboration between our countries.
Luis Guillermo Solis, former president of Costa Rica, now the interim chair of the Kimberly Green Latin American and Caribbean Center at FIU. President Solis, such a pleasure as always. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Luis. Have a great afternoon.
You as well. And just, man, it makes you think, you know, you don't think about it when you go to the supermarket, but there you go. As he said, one in seven fish illegal. All right, still to come, living with plastic. We're going to debate the best way to handle plastic pollution. Is it banning plastic or is it building better infrastructure for recycling? Tell us what you think. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Plastic pollution contributes to a lot of our environmental damage. But here's the kicker. Plastic is, it's practical, it's durable, and it's cheap. Florida has a state-level preemption that blocks local governments from banning single-use plastics, like supermarket plastic bags or straws. But some legislators are trying to fight that by introducing bills that would allow local plastic bans. Should plastics be banned altogether? Can we do it? Should governments invest in infrastructure to extend the lifespan, perhaps, of plastic? Well, we want to hear from you. What do you think on this? Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial, or email us sundial@wlrnnews.org. Maybe you found a way to live without plastics. I'd love to hear from you on that one. We've assembled a panel of experts and advocates to discuss this. Catherine Uden is the South Florida campaign organizer for Oceana. That's an ocean conservation organization. Catherine, great to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Definitely. And David Clement is with us. He's with the Consumer Choice Center Advocacy Group. David, thank you for the time today.
Thank you for having me.
And joining us, you've heard him on the show before, local environmental advocate Andrew Otazo. He's cleaned up tons of plastic trash from Biscayne Bay. You may have seen him if you follow him on Instagram. He takes a lot of pictures of himself out there cleaning up, and man, does he pick up a lot of stuff. Andrew, great to have you back.
It's a pleasure to be back. Thank you.
Also, we're going to be reading statements from some of the lawmakers who've introduced bills to allow local bans of plastic. That's throughout the program. Catherine, let me start with you. Let's talk about where things stand now. There's a state-level preemption that basically says local governments, you can't ban plastic, single-use plastics. You can't ban the plastic bags or the straws. But what do you think about that preemption? And, I mean, really, if not that, what's the best solution?
Yeah, so Oceana is in favor of this bill, and that's because scientists now estimate that 15 million metric tons of plastic washes into the ocean every year, and that's basically two garbage trucks worth of plastic entering the ocean every minute. Plastics are one of the greatest threats facing our oceans today, and this is a huge problem in Florida. A recent report from Oceana revealed that nearly 1,800 marine mammals and sea turtles have swallowed or become entangled in plastic along American coastlines. And the incidences of plastic killing or injuring these animals were higher off the coast of Florida and neighboring states than any other region in the US. So local governments' hands have been tied for quite a number of years now. We are unable to regulate this plastic pollution within our own communities. And there's a growing concern and there's a growing demand from residents to do something about this. And we would really appreciate that the state legislature would pass Senator Stewart and Representative Greco's bill. This is SB 594, HB 6027. And basically that would repeal the state preemption of the local rules governing the single-use plastic
and
products.
Of course, the session, of course, starting in March. David, what do you think? Is it local bans? Does that work? Should the state be able to ban it all? Or is there something else, another solution we're not thinking about here?
So Florida is an example, from the start, had me scratching my head because I do have to admit I thought the preemption to be a little strange. It is quite interesting from my perspective to say what a community can and cannot do. So I understand my colleagues' irritation with maybe some of the local autonomy concerns here.
Yeah.
But my opinion is that there is actually a better way than banning products. And that's primarily through focusing on chemical recycling and infrastructure efforts like chemical depolymerization and using those coupled with some serious reclamation efforts to ensure that plastic it stays in the economy and it doesn't end up in the environment. Because when I hear Kat explain the reality of plastic waste in our ecosystems, I mean, I don't think anybody could listen to that and not think that it's a serious problem. So it is one.
Yeah.
I just think that there are examples from other jurisdictions. I use Alberta, Canada as a example where they have really come up with some innovative ways to reclaim agricultural plastic waste, single-use plastic waste, and turn it into other products and extend the life cycle of that plastic indefinitely.
All right. So just to point out, no one thing is going to solve this problem. So we go from possibly banning certain items to maybe it's about reclaiming them, how we recycle them. Andrew, I just want to bring you in real quickly because, again, you are someone who sees where a lot of this plastic and a lot of the trash ends up because you're cleaning it up. But do you think that local governments should have the final say? Should that be something on the state level? Or maybe, as David's saying, maybe we need to put our efforts elsewhere.
I'd want your listeners to take a more bird's eye view of the plastic problem for a second. If you think of the life cycle of plastic, think of it as a stream where at the very top of the stream you have, or upstream, you have plastic manufacturers. At the bottom, you have the mangroves and the ocean. And in the middle, you have consumers. If we are relying, so I myself am out in the mangroves pretty regularly cleaning up trash. And if we rely on efforts just to essentially just to pick up the trash at the bottom of the stream, then we've lost. It's like going into your house and seeing your sink overflowing, and instead of turning off the tap, then just grabbing a mop and trying to mop up the floor. What we need to do is we need to go way farther up that life cycle. So to manufacturers, to bottlers, and yes, to consumers. But you know, one, either work with companies to try to reduce their use of plastic products within the materials, or for them to use alternative materials in their stead. And if that doesn't work, then use regulation and legislation. That is my perspective.
So three different ideas on this. Again, not saying any one is better than another. Catherine, coming back to this legislation, my understanding is that there is a way to get around that preemption, isn't there?
There is, but I want to say that I agree with what Andrew said. So the plastics industry has kind of been distracting consumers for decades with the promise of recycling, which we know has been ineffective. So only 9% of the plastic waste ever generated has been recycled, and really only 2% into something of equal or greater value. We need to reduce the source of the pollution upstream. And Oceana actually works at the local, state, and federal level on this issue. So we support local, state, and federal legislation. And
but again, on the preemption, getting around the preemption, how does that work?
So the way that we've been working at the local level, even with these preemptions, is local municipalities have been able to ban and prohibit certain single-use plastics that aren't preempted. So right now we have the preemptions with single-use plastic bags and polystyrene foam, but there are items that are not preempted, such as straws, utensils, and also what they've been doing is prohibiting these items on city property, municipal property. So what you can do is you can prohibit the use of, for example, polystyrene foam in your parks, on your beaches, in your events and your city contracts. So this is one way of getting around that preemption. And many municipalities have done this. There have already been 27 municipalities in Florida that have passed plastic straw laws, and at least 19 municipalities that have passed some sort of ordinance on other types of plastic or polystyrene foam.
All right. So we have a statement from State Representative Michael Grieco. Again, he represents parts of Miami-Dade County, and he introduced a bill to, again, greenlight these local bans. This is what he said, quote, "The elimination of single-use plastics and plastic bags is a no-brainer, especially for coastal communities like the one I represent. I authored the first and only still existing styrofoam ban in the state, Miami Beach, only to have Tallahassee preempt the remainder of Florida from doing the same," end quote. Look, we saw, and this is before this is why the state pushed their bill, because we saw communities, from Palm Beach to Surfside, Gainesville, Coral Gables, so many different communities banning, plastic, whether it's the bags or straws or other things. And then they were challenged in court. And so some of them had to walk back those bans. Catherine, I'm going to start with you. David, I want your response. But really, I mean, beyond the state, there are folks and businesses who are going to fight this, Catherine. If you let locals decide for themselves, it's still going to be challenged legally, and the courts may have shown us that the bans won't last.
I'm sorry, is that a question for me?
Yeah, let me start with you on that one. Just the idea that, you know what, there's going to be pushback and the courts may not be on your side.
Yeah, so if we can remove these preemptions, then we, local municipalities would be able to take action. They were challenged initially because, for example, Coral Gables, when they passed their bag and foam ban, that was just at the cusp of when these preemptions were coming about. So that's why they were challenged. If we could remove these preemptions, then we wouldn't need to worry about that. And municipalities would be able to control this pollution within their own cities.
David, your take on this?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I can't speak to the question of legality. I'm not a lawyer by trade, but what I can say is that what is often missed in this conversation is what the consequences are when we enact these bans. So a lot of people have written about the economic consequences, retailers, grocery stores, basically trying to get a leg up, trying to recover from the pandemic, and then being forced to transfer to new products. But one thing that I think it's important to stress out is that the alternatives that we force consumers to by banning these items are not necessarily better for the environment if we actually look at the totality of how they're created. And so the Danish Environment Ministry looked at the question of plastic bags. They evaluated plastic bags against the alternatives on 15 environmental measures, everything from climate change to the impact it has on water sources to acidification. And they concluded that more often than not, it's easier and better for the environment for consumers to have access to these plastic bags, and that we really should be talking about the process of reclaiming them. In their suggestion, it was reclaiming for the purpose of energy, but That's,
well, let me push back because something that Catherine said earlier, it also, yes, I've seen those reports, but then what about that fact that, again, when it comes to reclaiming recycling, a very small percentage of our plastics are actually recycled? I mean, less than 10%.
Yes, that stat is accurate, but that does not mean that the plastics are not recyclable. And there's an important distinction.
So we have to do more in the process of reclaiming and recycling, and that
absolutely.
I mean, okay, Andrew, just briefly, because what you said, think of it like a stream. If we're just dealing with a problem by the time it's downstream, do you think these bans locally work, or is that not going upstream enough?
I think that it's not an either or proposition. I think that there are certain materials that should absolutely be banned, like styrofoam. I see styrofoam, for example, on pars with chlorofluorocarbons, which were the chemicals in air conditioning units and all sorts of other products that were essentially putting a hole in the ozone layer. They do tremendous amounts of damage to the environment, and they're incredibly difficult to pick up. But I also want to talk a bit about the point of recycling. Recycling, as we have it now in this country, is a farce. It's basic economics. We used to, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we used to sell the majority of our recycled materials to China, and they're not buying anymore because they're not taking our trash. They have plenty of their own. And as a result, most of this that's collected is incinerated or it goes into landfills. And even the machine that we do have to repurpose recycled material can't handle most of this material that's being fed into it. So, like, for example, plastic bags, that is, the subject of our talk today, or one of them.
Yeah.
They will get into the machinery. They will get into essentially the cogs and muck it all up. And it is an incredible amount of energy that needs to be put into turning those low quality plastic products into something, that can actually be usable. And the economics simply do not work currently.
And this is almost another topic at some point, is the issue of recycling. Yes, you're right. It's not that all plastics are equal and they're all the same. And when we recycle them, we have to separate them. And beyond the separation that we ask consumers to do when they put their recyclables into the blue, bins, is even beyond that, we then have to separate more. Because, yes, they're not all going to be, handled the same way. Again, I'm talking with a panel of experts and advocates about plastic pollution and what is the best way to deal with this. Should we just ban it altogether? Or is it something we have to invest in infrastructure, in recycling, maybe doing more of that? Again, our guests are Catherine Uden. She is the South Florida campaign organizer for Oceana. David Clement is with Consumer Choice Center Advocacy. And, of course, we're talking with local environment advocate Andrew Utaso. And we heard from some of you. Gary Rosenberg emailed us. He says, I'm a paddleboarder, and the amount of plastic garbage I see floating on the surface and just below the surface in the bay, and especially in Indian Creek, is heartbreaking. Nobody ever cleans it up, though I've made numerous complaints to the city. Now there's a new addition to break your heart, COVID masks. This is a body of water shared by dolphins and manatees, which I just saw this morning. That's true. I'm seeing a lot more of those masks. We also heard from Lupe Brunman on Twitter. She says, I'm in favor of prohibiting single-use plastic and have started by eliminating plastics in my own home. As such, we should also be doing more towards recycling and would be in favor of a combined approach. It starts with education of the buying habits of the consumer. That's an interesting point. Thank you so much for it. Again, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Catherine, I wanted your thoughts on coming back to something Andrew said earlier on the alternatives and maybe education, which one of our listeners just talked about. And look, here's a reality, Catherine. I'm looking around my apartment, and it's not just the plastic bags and the straws. Almost everything I own is plastic or has plastic in it. How in the world can I get around that?
Yeah, so obviously consumers can look at their choices partially vote through their wallet and make sure that you know, we're making good choices. However, you know, the plastics industry not only wants us to focus on the waste portion of the life cycle and recycling, but they want us to focus on consumer choices and consumer blame and responsibility, when really we need to ask companies to reduce the amount of plastic they are putting into the supply chain and find alternative ways to package and deliver their products. Often consumers are not even given a choice when they go to the stores in plastic-free, you know, material, you know, items that they want to purchase. So we need national, state, and local governments to pass policies to make sure that companies have extended producer responsibility.
I think, I mean, but the you know, just to push back a little bit, the hard part is the fact that, you know, as a consumer, we want to buy things. So we, you know, mm-hmm. but a lot of the things we buy are wrapped in plastic containers, or they have plastic in it, and it's hard to get around. There may not be a lot Correct. Of options. I may not have yeah. options.
And I'd just like to point out that there are obviously problematic plastics. So the things that we're talking about that end up in water sources, which is really something that needs to be aggressively tackled. But then there are legitimate and environmentally conscious reasons for why we use plastic. And that would be, depending on the product, the differences between a glass container for something like baby food and a plastic container. It's about 33% better for the environment to have that product be in plastic, because it's lighter. It's easier to get to your grocery shelf. It costs less in terms of fuel and emissions. And so there are some good reasons on why we use plastic from an environmental perspective. And so it's important to realize that in the conversation, that it's not all negative. There's issues in terms of where it ends up. And I think we can tackle that. But I'd be hesitant to go so far as to saying that all plastics are the issue, which unfortunately can't happen.
No, we can't get rid of plastics. I mean, it's just it's in, and I keep pointing, I'm looking. It is in everything that we have. Andrew, when you clean up, when you go out to the bay, you see everything. It's not just plastic bags and straws. I mean, you find trash that's coming from all over the world.
Right. Yeah. To date, I've removed 13,600 pounds of trash over 3 years now. And like you said, it is from all over the world. I find items from Cuba, Haiti, the Dominican Republic, South America, all the time. Not to mention, I found like the side of a ship that came from Louisiana. So it is everything you could possibly imagine. And we do focus on certain items like plastic bags. I myself brought up styrofoam earlier, plastic bottles, things like that. But people don't realize that everything we produce as a civilization winds up in the ocean. I have found enough car parts to put together my own F-150, essentially. And everything, like medical supplies, like entire pallets of all sorts of different goods you can possibly imagine. That's all in the ocean.
Yeah. Now, I want to come back to this, too, because we did get a statement from State Senator Linda Stewart. She represents parts of Central Florida, also, again, introducing a bill to allow the ban of plastics by local governments. This is what she said. Quote, "We're seeking to give home rule back to cities and counties by allowing them to decide what type of regulation best fits their needs. Coastal or lakefront communities may wish to ban these containers or single-use plastics in order to reduce pollution and protect other sectors of their economies, such as tourism." Again, that's from State Senator Linda Stewart. And this goes back to, again, pushing back on the state law that takes away the power from local governments. Local governments were trying to ban plastics on their own, and the state decided you can't do that. Catherine, I come back to you on this one. You've got a Republican House, Republican Senate. You've got a Republican in the, you know, the governor's mansion. What chance does this have of passing this time around?
Well, the thing is that plastic reduction policies have been enacted and proven to be successful in other parts of the U.S. and across the world, even in conservative areas. So if they can do it, so can we. There are bag bans in South Carolina. So entire nations are passing plastic reduction policies, and they've been proven to work. There's data to back that up. And, you know, the things that local governments are trying to control within their cities are the top 10 most common waste items found in worldwide beach cleanups. They're the single-use plastic packaging items. So
let me ask you something that David brought up earlier, which is the issue that, like, for example, the plastic bags, but also the straws, you know, we're talking about items that businesses like restaurants use, and for them, it's a cost-effective issue. And look, these businesses have been destroyed by the pandemic. How do we help them, you know, bounce back from this pandemic, but at the same time tell them, we're going to put restraints on you and you just can't use these cost-effective items because, sorry, it's polluting. And, well, you just we got to do something about it. What do you say to them?
Yeah, this is a very difficult time indeed. Nobody can debate that, but thankfully this pandemic won't last forever. But the plastic pollution problem affects human health and threatens our economy. And it's a long-term problem that's getting worse and worse. And we really need to do something about it. I've been working with business owners and so have many environmental organizations here to help business owners transition and switch. And because of these policies, these products have become more readily available. The cost is going down. And, you know, there's so many organizations that are willing to reach out to these business owners and help them make this transition. And I also want to stress that we are not asking people to go from one disposable product to another.
Right.
There was a time where we used refillable and reusable solutions in the past, and we can expand on that now.
There's a lot to discuss. Unfortunately, I just ran out of time on the program. There's so much to discuss on this issue, but I want to thank my guests again, Catherine Uden with the South Florida Campaign Organization Oceana, also David Clement with Consumer Choice Center Advocacy, and Andrew Atasso. Always a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much, all of you, for sharing with us just things to think about. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
And that is our program for this Thursday, February 4th. And listen, keep the conversation going online on our Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial, because we want to hear your thoughts on how we can solve this problem. Coming up next week on the show, our class of COVID project launches on Monday. A team of reporters from WLRN and other stations have explored all the ways the pandemic has impacted children and their learning. And we're going to dig into that starting next week. All of that coming up next week on the program. And of course, we'll keep you updated on the Senate hearings on the impeachment as well. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful Friday, a great weekend. Nice weather ahead. Stay safe. Be good to each other. We'll talk to you again live on Monday.